things a little bit out of order. And actually, we're going to start, Mr. Joseph, I think, with your bill that you're covering, and that is Senate Bill 391. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 391.
Sure.
And I don't have a witness sheet, so if you could maybe get me that first. Oh, okay. All right. So Senate Bill 391, and we are privileged to have Judge Whitmire with us. Your Honor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Whitmire. I'm a circuit judge from Multnomah County. I have written testimony that I've prepared for the committee as well, but I'd like to comment on a few of the issues in Senate Bill 391. Senate Bill 391 was introduced by my state Senator Frank Shields at my request because I'm concerned about the way we spend our time, the way court staff spends its time, and I'm concerned about the condition of the state budget. I'm here today speaking only for myself. I do not speak for my presiding judge, the other 36 judges on my court, or the other judges in the Oregon Judicial Department, or the Chief Justice and the State Court Administrator. Mm-hmm. In the 7 years I've been a judge, I've learned that judges and court staff provide lots of valuable services for the benefit of the public. And setting aside criminal matters, which is a big piece of our work, and talking only about the non-criminal matters that we were involved in, the only thing I can think of that we do for free is weddings. We charge substantial fees for almost all of the services we provide to the public in connection with civil matters, such as adoptions, civil lawsuits. There are filing fees for all kinds of things. If you get sued in circuit court in order to defend yourself to avoid a default judgment, you have to pay $135 first appearance fee, filing fee. We charge $85 to file a petition for adoption. It costs $300 to file a petition for dissolution of marriage. A $25 fee for a wedding service is, truthfully, a small number compared to all of those other services that the courts provide. Under current law, there is no fee at all that's permissible to be charged for the benefit of the taxpayers of the state of Oregon for weddings performed by judges. Current law does allow judges to personally charge a fee not to exceed $100 for weddings that judges perform outside of normal working hours outside of the courthouse facility. The theory being, I imagine, that that's work done on the judge's own time. Judges are allowed by law to charge a personal fee, but none of that money goes to the taxpayers. None of it helps the Oregon Judicial Department. None of it helps the general fund of the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 391 proposes to make a small correction to that, to require in Senate Bill 391's current form as passed by the Senate, to require a $25 fee to be charged, to be paid to the clerk of the court by the to-be-married couple for the benefit of the general fund. I know there are amendments to be proposed to Senate Bill 391, which I'll touch on in a moment, but in its current form, it would require a $25 fee for all weddings performed by judges, those in the courthouse during working hours, and the evening and weekend weddings also. The Oregon Judicial Department estimates that somewhere in the range of 5,300 weddings a year are performed by state court judges, separate and apart from municipal judges and justices of the peace. And that at $25 per wedding, this would generate net revenues, net of the cost of collecting the revenue, somewhere in the range of $250,000 per biennium. Now, I know that $250,000 may be a drop in the bucket, considering the problems that you folks struggle with on a daily basis here on behalf of the state. But when I look at my court clerk and my judicial assistant, who took a 10% pay cut since March 1st, and when I don't look at the people who don't work for our court anymore because they got laid off because of our budget reductions, I think $250,000 over a biennium spread out among the state would have preserved a couple of jobs, or several jobs, and certainly some people full-time. And these are human beings who work hard for the benefit of the public, and we should do everything we can to provide the opportunity for them to continue to do that work. I know our work has certainly slowed down because of reductions in our staff, and I think that revenue would help that to some extent. There are a number of amendments that I've seen today. There's the -4 amendments and the -6 amendments. And for the most part, I think those amendments are a great idea, and I appreciate Senator Shields' efforts to continue to work with people who are interested in Senate Bill 391 to make it better. I think that's one of the advantages of the legislative process, because an idea gets input from lots of other people and hopefully gets better as it progresses through, as opposed to other ways that we get laws that don't get the chance to have input from other people. So I think most of the proposed amendments are a great idea, and I endorse the idea of removing the municipal judges and the justices of the peace from this bill. That was not part of my original idea, although it's certainly the way it was written up. I'm concerned about the state budget and the Oregon Judicial Department, and I think it's just fine to put that money into a special fund to cover the cost of operating this service, providing this service to the public, as provided for in the -4A amendments. There's some difference between the -4A and the -6A amendments, and I don't quite understand how these work. The -4A amendments eliminate the requirement that this fee be charged for the evening and weekend after hours weddings if there's no court staff or court resources involved. The -6 amendments change that to eliminate the need for the fee if there's only minimal court staff or court resources involved. And where one draws the line between no involvement and minimal involvement, I think, is going to always be in the judgment of the judge involved, I suppose. And I think even without the difference in the -6 amendments about that, I think that it would probably work just fine as written in the -4A amendments. But it's a difficult thing to evaluate. I certainly appreciate the suggestion in the -A6 amendments that the Chief Justice has the authority to develop procedures for waiving the fee in the case of indigency. I think that's a wonderful idea. Absent statutory authority, we don't waive fees. There's lots of statutory authority for that, and we do it in lots of circumstances. But that's because there's authority, and I appreciate that the -A6 amendments contain that provision. So those are my suggestions. I appreciate the committee's consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
Thank you, Your Honor. Apparently, the A4 amendments have not been distributed to the committee, so those are being copied. And
Mr.
We'll
Chairman,
get a chance to look at those. Yes.
The -A6s should incorporate everything in the -A4s, with the exception of that change on the policy of when we would either collect or waive the fee based on what type of staff resources are used. And I was just looking at my amendment requests. I have combined over time the A3s and A4s to make the A5s, and then I believe I worked with Representative Przanski and others, some of the judges who wrote to me, to create the A6s. So those should be the only operable amendments.
Are the A6s?
Are the A6s, okay. Correct.
The other change that I think is a difference from the original bill as it came over is in Section 1 of the A6s, which would extend the ability for a judge to perform a wedding to an active judge of the federal court or an active United States magistrate judge. Currently, they're not allowed to marry in Oregon, and we did have a bill that I believe it was Representative Przanski that had filed that bill as a House bill, which we chose not to take action on as a committee, knowing that this bill was on its way with the appropriate relating clause and figured we'd do them all in one vehicle. And that was at the request of
Judge Ann Aiken.
Judge Aiken, that's right. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, if this is appropriate time, maybe
sure.
I can call the record.
Sure.
Regarding that, there was some discussions with some of the other federal judges as to the terminology or how this approach should be. One of the suggestions that was given to me was maybe have it where these federal magistrates or judges could apply to the Chief Justice to get that approval, as compared to having it just applied to the act. Of my understanding, some of the senior judges do not care to participate in this. I made the decision to do it as it is set forth in the A6s, because no matter what, these individual judges, their offices would or will be contacted to see whether or not they will perform these weddings. and I do not see why we should require the judge themselves and the judicial department to have to go through some type of application process. I think that would actually prolong and cost the system much more money. And so either way, if a judge doesn't want to participate, it's my opinion that they will be able to just tell the individual that they are not performing those type of weddings or in those weddings, and they need to go somewhere else, as compared to shouldering the burden on the judicial department to receive applications and then process all that paperwork.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. Are there questions for Judge Whitmire? Yes, Representative Anderson, you want to move your mic close?
Mr. Chairman.
Judge Whitmire, is there a reason why you're taking the municipal and the justice piece out? It would seem like that might drive more to the circuit court.
Well,
or from the either way, depending
my concern,
on the seat.
Thank you for your question, Representative Anderson. And Mr. Chairman, my concern was the state budget. My concern was the crisis we're all in financially, and the as I see the withering of personnel in our court, my concern was how can we generate revenue so that that stops or at least slows down. And of course, that concern didn't call into play anything with respect to the municipal judges and the justices of the peace. The way the bill was originally written, they were included because it was written in a way, in the most simple way, to simply amend the statute that affected judicial officers, which includes the state court judges, the justices of the peace, and the municipal judges. But they weren't a part of my original concern, and I know that the municipal judges and the JPs have some of their concerns because of the way in which they do business. Most of them, perhaps not all, but most of them are part-time employees who are paid either on contract or hourly or on some different basis than the state court judges. We are paid an annual salary, and so I think the issues are different, the budgetary issues. I know for sure that some of the JPs, at least sometimes, when they do weddings, the arrangements are made through their private law offices, with no taxpayer involvement at all. And my concern was really staff involvement that the people of Oregon pay for, because I see a lot of staff involvement. I know all judges don't do it that way, but I know that there is a lot of staff involvement in these things. It takes time, it slows down the other work of the court. So that's why it wasn't my issue, frankly.
Okay. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Maybe to the judge or the staff. Anybody? Aren't county clerks also authorized to perform marriages?
Yes, Representative Shetterly and Chair Whitman. They are. And the bill, the current law, authorizes county clerks to perform weddings and requires a fee of $15 to be paid to the clerk for doing that. Now, I'm told that the county clerk in Multnomah County does not do weddings. The statute doesn't require them to do weddings. It permits them to and requires the fee if they do them. And I think no weddings are performed in Multnomah County by the clerk. I'm not positive about that, but I am told that. This bill would raise the fee for county clerks from $15 to $25, exactly the same as it would be for state court judges.
Oh, I see that they are in the statute. Okay.
And that change was added by legislative counsel before the bill was introduced in the Senate. My original idea was only with respect to judges. And, of course, I wasn't aware of how it worked with the county clerks, but legislative counsel was aware of that and added that so that we would have some consistency.
Okay. Are there further questions for His Honor? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks.
We have Judge Ed Jones here as well. Judge Jones, do you want to come forward?
Good morning, everybody. Chairman, Representative Williams, other members of the committee. I'm also a circuit court judge in Multnomah County, as John is. I perform a lot of weddings, one every day, really. 8:30 in the morning, I do a wedding every day. And there isn't much staff time involved in that. I'm quite comfortable with the idea that weddings are underpriced currently, and that we could easily add $25 to the cost of a wedding and not substantially discourage the public from getting married. I like the idea of having the waiver possibility. But the one thing that I look at about this is that if we move away from the focus on judicial activity, we could avoid a double collection. Right now, as this bill stands, people would pay at the county clerk's office the wedding fee. Then they would have to come down to the courthouse and pay a second fee. For the people I marry, they can't do that at 8:30 in the morning. And it seems to me that simply rolling the fee into the initial cost of the wedding, first of all, it captures all weddings, not just judge weddings, which would significantly increase the revenue stream. And secondly, the state does have an involvement in every wedding because when people file those documents, they file them with the county clerk, then the state gets a copy, and when you go buy a certified copy of your wedding license, you can get it from the county or you can get it from the state. Actually, they charge different prices. I haven't figured out why that is. But so the state is involved in every process, and there really would not be a reason simply to say, we're going to add $25 to the cost of every wedding, collect it up front at the clerk's, avoid that second collection in the courthouse, which is an additional cost to our system, generate more revenue, and not have that second payment. And so that would be, you know, if we were going to rework this, and as I said, I think weddings are underpriced so that we can successfully do that, but why should we stop at just the ones that judges do? Why not roll a $25 fee into every wedding, have the clerks collect it up front, the county clerks, and send it to the state? And then if you want to divvy it up by the number of judge weddings and kick a little back to the judicial branch, we'd love to see the money. But, you know.
Your Honor, I think one of the issues is, and maybe there's a way that this is tracked. I've never seen any numbers, actually, on how many judge-performed weddings.
There are some numbers in the material that was prepared for this bill.
Right. I mean, they did. I think they finally developed some of those numbers in trying to figure out what the fiscal would constitute. But I think one of the ideas is that, you know, if you're performing the wedding at the court, you know, there is some involvement of, you know, staff time or use of the chamber, or even if you're outside on the steps, you know, your judicial assistant is going to probably be, you know, helping you get your robe on and get out there to be at the place you need to be on time. And so, you know, what happens is if we just jack the price up on all the weddings everywhere, while I'm not fundamentally, I guess, opposed to that concept, I think the difference is, you know, you're a little bit like you're sort of playing the role like the minister plays, and if you get them at the gate at the clerk's office on an increased wedding fee, a lot of people who choose not to have a judge marry them hop in their car and they drive across town to the church on the designated day, and they still got to slip the minister a couple of bucks to get that part performed.
Right, and people routinely will try to give the judge some money. I mean, Maybe
so,
twice
so
a month.
That's all we're trying to do is we're trying to get them to slip you a couple of bucks that comes into the system.
I'm liking this better and better.
When you're acting like the minister, that they're going to have to go out and pay if they're not coming to a judge to get it handled. And I think that's essentially the reason why there might be less resistance when we're charging for the judges performing the wedding than if we slap an overall increase on the fee on just the cost of getting the wedding license.
Right. Although I don't think there's going to be much resistance either way. If it doesn't, at least if that resistance doesn't show up here, when would it happen?
Well, if we went to a broad-based fee, you might be surprised at the number of people who suggest, because I've been down this road before when we increase the wedding fee and people say we start to have a disincentive. If you put it on everybody, an overall disincentive on people to go through the process. But
this process has been the subject of considerable discussion among the judges since John made this proposal.
I mean, it's very popular right now.
Well, no, actually, there's a huge it's almost a given when you have a group of judges that there will be no consensus about anything. So there's a lot of different opinions about it. And nobody disputes that the revenue is there to be had. I find the complications of this to be, frankly, not worth, you know, it's more complicated than it needs to be. And just the savings and getting it up front and then divvying it up later strike me as being a more satisfactory and generates more revenue than this proposal. The last thing we really need to do is be having waiver hearings about discussions about what's the guideline income at which we waive the $25. You know, we don't even need to have that discussion. Make them all pay it. Anyway, if there are any questions, I'd entertain them. But.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to hopefully add some clarification to the intent behind the amendments. On the -A6s, the intent of the last section, the first page, section 4, little a, was to allow either the clerk of the county clerk or the clerk of the court to collect all the fees that we're discussing here in one place, and if they would need to provide some sort of receipt for the judge, so that it can be clear that all the fees have been paid. We were trying to avoid the very problem of having fees paid in multiple places. If you look on page 2 in the center, subsection 3, which is being removed on line 15, now becoming subsection 5, judges would still be able to charge an additional fee, as I understand it, if they're performing the marriage outside of the courthouse. And the provision above that, I'm kind of skipping around a little bit, but on line 8, large C, talking about a minimal amount of staff time, I think it was the intent to allow the court, if the court so chose to create a standard point at which they might waive a fee, that they would also, if they chose to do so, establish what constitutes a minimal amount of staff time. So it was the intention to be able to collect the fee in one place, all the fees that are collected, because a judge wouldn't normally charge an additional fee if they were doing the wedding at the courthouse. If they were going to charge an additional fee outside the courthouse, then this bill, as I understand it, they just pay that $25 fee for the marriage license. The other fee would be dealt with separately. And the court could develop a standardized procedure for what constitutes minimal staff time, at which time the fee would be applicable, and when could you waive the fee.
Judge?
Now, I have to say I'm a little confused by that. How would the clerk, county clerk, he would say, okay, it's an extra $25 if you're going to go to the judge?
That would be the intention. I didn't understand necessarily that there were two charges of $25. It was just going to be, it costs $25 to get married by a judge, unless there's a separate fee for the marriage license.
There is.
Okay.
There is. That's the separate fee. But I think the intent of the sub 4 little a, where it would allow the clerk of the court or the county clerk to collect the fee of $25 and deposit the fee of the Judicial Department Operations Fund. So at least it allows for what you suggested, right, which is a single point collection. But it would obviously probably be the responsibility of the local presiding court right, to work out an arrangement with the clerk to decide how that's going to happen.
You know, and Representative Prohanska, you mentioned this question of how the federal judges get involved in the process or whether they'd want to be bothered or not. Currently, in most, at least in our county, when you get a wedding license, the county clerk gives you a sheet which lists the judges in Multnomah County who are willing to do weddings.
Oh, that's good to hear.
So then you're not calling, and only, John, about 15 of our 40 judges are on that list. Is that about right? So only about 15 of our judges are actually on that list and doing weddings on any organized basis. Everybody doesn't get calls. In other words, it's not like they work starting with aardvark down through the list,
right,
to find somebody who will do it. They're given a sheet to start with.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow.
You may.
And it sounds like if the federal judges wanted to, let's say, have their names listed on that,
right,
list, they would be able to go through the clerk.
Exactly.
To do that. That's,
yeah,
fantastic.
And if Mr. Chairman, I think the intention was that if a couple came in and paid for the marriage license and said we would like to be, you know, and knew at that point they wanted to be married by a judge, the clerk, the county clerk, could collect $50, give them some kind of a receipt showing that they've paid that amount, and then they can go to whatever judge they choose. If it's that they later decide that they want to get married by a judge, well, they could still go and then pay that fee at the courthouse. But the hope was, at least, you know, those people who had the foresight to determine that they wanted to be married by a judge in a court could pay that up front at one place.
That would certainly be a big step in the right direction. All right, thank you, unless there's any other questions. So.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Judge Whitmire wanted to say one additional thing in,
sure,
light of the other judge's comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had asked about some numbers, and the Judicial Department did an analysis of the fiscal impact of this, and the most recent numbers are available are those for 2001 weddings. There were In 2001, there were 7,921 weddings performed in Oregon that were, quote, civil, end quote, weddings. And by that, I trust the distinction is between civil versus religious weddings, those performed by clergy and so forth. A breakdown was a statistical breakdown of that was done comparing the number of state court judges who do what, the number of state court judges to the number of justices of the peace and municipal judges. Although I think there are no records that show how many weddings were done by each of those groups or each of the individuals within those groups, there were 35.6% of the judicial officers are municipal judges and justices of the peace, and 57.34% are state court judges. So the assumption was made that you multiply the number of civil weddings by the number of by the percentage of the judges who are or judicial officers who are state court judges, and you come up with 5,348 weddings performed in a year by state court judges. The gross revenue that would produce in a biennium is $267,422. There's been an analysis of the cost of collecting this money. Four trial court administrators around the state were consulted by the Judicial Department, and they did an analysis of what does it cost to pay court operations specialists, clerks, to receive the money, to issue a receipt, to enter into the computer system, the transaction. How long does it take to do that, and what is the cost of those of the salary for those people? And multiplied by the number of weddings, and the cost of collecting this money would be $17,115. So the net new revenue would be $250,307 based on 2001 numbers for state court judges. That's the appellate judges, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the one tax court judge, I don't know if he does weddings, and the, I think, 166 circuit judges around the state. So those, if that answers your question, Mr. Chairman, about the numbers.
No, that's very helpful. Be interesting to be married by it. Maybe the tax court judge only does it on December 31st.
Maybe that. Or April 15th. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify on this scintillating topic? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 391. I'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I'll move the A6 into Senate Bill 391.
Representative Przanski moves the dash A6 amendments to Senate Bill 391. Is there discussion on the motion? Any objection to the A6s? They're in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll now move Senate Bill 391 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 391 as amended by the A6 amendments to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there discussion on this motion? Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fascinated by the language in the bill and in the amendment that has now become part of the bill with regards to the waiver. And I would share the judge's concern about having waiver hearings all of a sudden. I didn't understand what exigent circumstances were, and so I looked it up in the dictionary, and exigent means to need immediate attention.
That's that shotgun wedding.
That's the one. I think that's the one that they're talking about. You're absolutely right.
We had LC change it from shotgun to exigent.
Yeah. Either he marries her or they're going to have a murder trial. The other thing is that I'm a little bit fascinated by and kind of bothered by to a certain extent, and that is including but not limited to the indigency of the parties to the marriage. Quite frankly, I think that if somebody can't afford to pay $25 to get married, they probably can't afford to get married, and they probably ought not be getting married. And maybe there's something there to tell them. But anyway, I guess I'm just fascinated by the bill. I'll vote for it, but I'm not sure why.
Okay.
I hope the hell nobody asked me.
Well, counsel just passed me a note and asked if it was actually cheaper to live in sin, and I think we're actually trying to work out that marriage discrepancy in the tax thing, but that's in the Revenue Committee. So
that fiscal impact statement is on its way, as I understand.
Yeah, right. All right. Anybody else? Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Rogers.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Schultz.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Senate Bill 391, as amended, will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Przanski will carry. All right, we're now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 267. Council, why don't you bring us up to speed on the bill, and thank you, Mr.
Chair, members of the committee. You have before you Senate Bill 267 relating to public safety. It comes to you from the Committee on Judiciary at the request of AFSCME, and it creates a position on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training for a representative of the largest collective bargaining unit in the Department of Corrections, and creates a position on the Corrections Policy Committee for a female employee in the Department of Corrections employed as a woman's correctional at a woman's correctional facility. You also have a small amendment in front of you, the Dash 1 amendments, which would require evidence-based programs be phased in on the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, the State Commission on Children and Families, and that part of the Department of Human Services that deals with mental health and addictions issues. As chair members of the committee, you may remember way back at the beginning of session, we had an overview of the criminal justice system that we conducted in conjunction with the Public Safety Subcommittee. And at the end, you may remember one of the questions was raised of whether we should cull the herd or thin the soup. Subsequent to that, you and others met with some of the agency people concerning these issues. And one of the issues was raised that sometimes the legislature prevents them from applying evidence-based programs because of some programs are very important in particular communities. As a result, we put together a draft, and the evidence-based program here, the language, some of it is based in federal law, and it was modified by the work group. And this will be phased in over starting in the next biennium and then finishing in the year 2009 biennium. And even though it's you have a several people signed up to testify.
Right, and we'll bring people up to testify on the Dash 1 amendments. I'll just make sort of an introductory remark. Committee, this is consistent, I think, with some of the discussions we had earlier in the mm-hmm. session as we went through our committee overview early on, and presentations both when we were meeting in conjunction with the folks down in the other related committees and the subcommittee of the Ways and Means process. But also then the presentations we had from Ed Latessa and others about trying to get ourselves focused on spending state resources tied to programs that have some construction in their implementation that we know actually has and produces the results that we're attempting to accomplish based on kind of longitudinal scientific analysis to tell us what is likely going to happen. Also in the materials you've got is a document which we received not that long ago, actually, from the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, which is a combined joint initiative by the Justice Department's Office of Justice Programs and the Coalition of Evidence-Based Policy, funded in part by grants from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Jerry Lee Foundation, that provides some pretty interesting information about efforts that they're trying to make on the federal level to do much the same thing, to drive these dollars from a prevention standpoint into programs that have had the work invested in them in such a way that you know what you're likely going to get when you go down that road. We met consistently with most of the stakeholders directly affected by the amendments to this bill, and much of the amendment that you see before you is essentially from their efforts of working together to come up with a methodology for phasing this concept in over a period of time to allow some initial experience with it, recognizing that a number of the programs that are currently being run probably don't meet initially these tests, and that it would take some time to retool and appropriately do this. Now, I've joked with them that, and only half joked, I think, and they recognize this, that if a few years from now we get back to a position where we ask them, okay, based on this, what programs don't you do, you know, a few years from now that they're doing now, and the answer is none, all of them met the standard, then we cast the net too broadly and defined what evidence-based program is too broadly, because my sense is, and I think they would agree, although they may not be willing to necessarily in this hearing today name the names of the programs they've got doubts about, they know they've got some things that they're doing right now that don't have any basis upon which to show that the results are actually going to be there. And so this is about culling the herd and not thinning the soup and trying to focus our resources in a manner that are best going to achieve the goals that we want to get to. So that's the introductory statement from me. Representative Patridge on the Ways and Means Committee met with me and this group in active meetings over a period of a couple of months off and on, and that's what the Dash 1 amendment is. So with that introduction, I want to start by asking Phil Lemon, Donna Middleton, Karen Brazeau, and Ben DeHaan if they would all come forward. And you know what? Well, I've got the four of you up here. Let's pull up an extra chair. We'll need an extra chair. And Bob Nickel, why don't I have you come up, too? I think you need to be up here, too. Maybe one of you can pull up on the other side of Phil here.
Don't want to be outflanked, Mr. Chair.
Either way, now you blanked you. Okay, yeah. All right, and the reason that you know you guys all participated in these meetings, and so this is really your opportunity to talk to the committee about the amendment and about any issues that you want to bring forward and what your sense is about this. I know everybody has a bit of a varying degree of comfort level with where this is headed, and this is the opportunity I think for the committee to understand that. And I think I'm just going to pick on Mr. Lemon first, and then we'll just go from there. Is that all right with you, Phil?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Phil Lemon. I'm the director of the State Criminal Justice Commission, and as you probably know, the Criminal Justice Commission administers juvenile crime prevention grants available to all 36 Oregon counties and 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon to reduce juvenile crime. I've attached for your information the evaluation report that we gave the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means to discuss the effectiveness of those programs in whole. They did not do an individual program-by-program evaluation. But I just want to let you know that we have had that function evaluated by the University of Oregon Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior. The co-director of that institute is Dr. Hill Walker, who's addressed this committee on how to evaluate and measure the effectiveness of these type of programs. The other little caveat I need to put out here is that I work for the Criminal Justice Commission and I staff the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, and neither of those bodies has taken a position on this legislation, so I'm not here to represent those bodies. I do want to add my support to the amendments. I think it's a very important direction that we're heading in, and I would like to thank the chair for his efforts and interest in moving us in that direction. I did want to add a couple comments. On the definition of scientifically based research in the bill, we originally looked at it and adopting the language from the No Child Left Behind Act, which is a federal education legislation, until we came to the point where we discovered that the feds are going to take 2 to 3 years to come up with a list of programs that they think meet that definition. And we didn't think that that timeline was necessary or advisable, so we modified the definition, which we still think gives us a good screening mechanism. Will increasingly require the programs and services that seek state funding to demonstrate a reliance on a solid research basis. And so we're taking that approach. On definition of cost effective, this will require each of our agencies to quantify the costs that are either saved or avoided by implementing these evidence-based programs. I would just like to point out that that's going to be a new area of undertaking for us, and I think for the criminal justice system generally. And we're going to, I think, have a lot of issues to work through there with you. And so I think the reporting back and phasing this in is going to be a very important piece of this legislation for all of us. Other challenges that I think that we all face, both either as the legislative branch or at the executive branch, is first of all that this body continues to look at funding evaluation processes. That's often the first thing to go. We're in a budget reduction environment, and so I think that there is some potential here to set prevention programs up for failure if you do not fund evaluation processes that give us a demonstrated effect, whether they work or they don't work. The default here is if we can't prove that they work, they don't get funded. And so I think continuing to fund those evaluation efforts is going to be critical. I would, again, on the like you to consider the types of programs that are and are not considered programs subject to this legislation, and think you should keep an eye on that to, so you can look at what we are and are not including in our definitions. And finally, is that right now there is a dearth of research evaluation that would meet the definite the criteria in this legislation, specifically for programs aimed in rural communities and also those aimed at minority youth. And so those are going to be areas that we're going to have to work a little harder on and take another look at to make sure that we're not excluding those types of programs just because there is not the research and evaluation basis available.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask a question on that?
You may.
Phil, could you, elaborate as to how are we going to have this oversight or review to make certain these type of programs aren't going to be jeopardized while we go through this transition? Will they continue to be able to be used? And if they don't have the funding themselves to document what we need, how do we or will we assist them in meeting those that criteria check?
There are a couple answers to that. One is that this is a phased-in requirement, mm-hmm. and we will be each of our agencies will be adopting rules to kind of flesh out what we define as cost-effective, how we view the research base, and the report that's required back to the Assembly requires a program-by-program assessment on whether this is or is not an evidence-based program under the definition of this bill. And one of the reasons I strongly advocated for a phase-in like that is because it gives us a period of time where we can go through and do that inventory, identify where we think we're weak on some of these things, and then take steps to do that. As far as the juvenile crime prevention grants that my agency funds, we do have evaluation funding in that. We also have the ability to use some federal funding to provide some evaluations and to strengthen that up to the extent we see the need to do that. I think in addition that the rural communities, minority populations are, everyone knows that those, we do not have adequate evaluation findings on those, and there are efforts underway to beef that up at the federal level as well. But that's just an area that I wanted to make sure that you are aware of that we're going to have to work through as we implement this legislation.
Okay. Anything else, Phil? All right. Who wants to go next? Donna, all right.
Members of the committee, my name for the record is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. I just have a couple of things to add to Phil's comments. I agree with Phil's comments and want to say that I, too, was a member of this work group and appreciate the work of Representative Williams, Representative Patridge, and Senator Minnis in coming together with us to work through some of the issues around evidence-based language. I also want to say that the State Commission itself has not taken a position on this legislation. They just received a copy of the bill on Friday and are still reviewing it. So I'm speaking as a member of the work group as well with Phil. I do want to say a couple of things that I really appreciate about the legislation. The one is that we're able to draft administrative rules. What we have talked about as an agency's plural is to draft administrative rules together. So that when communities see the rules, they see them as similar pieces of information that go out from a number of agencies around evidence-based. Usually what we do is we develop administrative rules singularly, and sometimes they're in conflict with one another, sometimes they have definitions that are not the same. We have agreed, and this piece of legislation I think has helped bring us to that conclusion, that we all need to be saying the same thing to our community and our partners and our providers, and I think that's a good thing. The second thing I just want to support is the phase-in of this process. We have a number of folks who, in rural areas and minority communities, that really will have difficulty in getting up to speed with evidence base. One, there isn't any evidence to review or to rely on, and two, these folks have very few dollars to support moving forward with evidence-based practices. The other good thing that's happened, not as a result of this legislation, but is the work that we're doing together, is we're going out in teams to provide technical assistance and support to communities to move them forward in these opportunities. And we'll continue to do that as a process in association with the legislation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna. Bob?
Thank you, Chair Williams. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator of the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in the Department of Human Services. And we're that part of the department that's referred to in the language as the part that deals with alcohol and drug and mental health problems. I, too, feel very strongly that this is a direction that the state agencies need to be going in. I'm fully supportive of the concept. I'm looking forward to the challenge. The state agency that I represent will need to make some adjustments. We need to shift some of the things that we've been doing so that we can absorb the costs of this within our current budget. And I think that's our responsibility, and I fully intend to do that. As far as the racial and ethnic issues, I think that it may look a little bit different in each of the areas. I'm familiar more with addictions and mental health research. And in some of the mental health literature, the some of the racial and ethnic groups are actually fairly well studied. And I think that we need to do a very good and thorough and accurate literature review to identify areas where we know something and those areas where we truly don't know enough yet. I think in conclusion, I just want to thank the chair of this committee for taking a leadership role in this and committee staff. And our office is going to work very hard to implement this with stakeholder input that will achieve the intent of the legislation.
Thank you very much, Bob. Kara.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Karen Brazeau. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and we provide services to delinquent youth in Oregon in a number of ways. We provide them directly to youth in the state's custody, both in our closed custody facilities and those youth that we supervise in communities. And we provide those through contractors, mostly private nonprofit contractors, sometimes for profit contractors. We also provide flow-through dollars to county juvenile departments to provide services to youth who remain in their communities, and the counties then provide those services either directly or through contracts. So we will be deeply involved with this bill, and it will provide a number of challenges. I am happy to see that the definition of research has expanded, I think, to include under this definition, we could include meta-analysis as a standard of effectiveness. And for the youth authority, that will be very important because for youth who are in the youth authority's custody, the research is a bit sketchy for youth who are on the deep end of delinquency, and as you've heard from me in the past, those youth are also overrepresented by minority youth, and once again, the researches of effective intervention programs for those youth is also sketchy. So we will be reporting back to you about our ability to actually move our interventions in that direction. I do think it's possible over the period of time that we've achieved through the phase-in. Other than that, I think you've heard of from the other work group members up here, I think the cost-effectiveness for defining that for the youth authority will be a challenge, since a lot of what we do is just provide care for kids and in so doing try to provide interventions mm-hmm. through direct care staff. So that'll be an interesting one to untangle. But we can do that, too.
Okay. Ben.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I've given you written testimony, and it probably would have made more sense if I had gone first, because a lot of it really contains information that's already been presented. I'll let you read that if you choose at your leisure. I just want to make a couple of more points that have not been addressed yet. Obviously, in sitting here, I'm here to support the Dash 1 amendments. The department is 100% on this. We think that we can implement the bill without any difficulty. It's very consonant with the direction that we've been moving in to date. We're happy with it. One of the things that I think the committee needs to consider when we think about the absence of support for a program, it doesn't take into consideration that we have had experts sitting at this table telling you that we can indeed make things much worse. So just failing to demonstrate the effectiveness of a program isn't the whole thing, both in the area of the juvenile corrections and in adults. We can spend money and make people more dangerous. And so the absence of research findings is even more compelling now than we once thought. I think the other thing to I would really like to emphasize is that the department really is, speaking for the Department of Corrections, and we have taken a position on this, we're ready to go. We're fully capable of implementing it without any new resources now. So that's all I have to say, and I'll answer any questions you have.
All right, good. Are there questions for the panel? Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am certainly in favor of the idea of evidence-based research. I had a long discussion with a constituent last night that has a program in Josephine County, and his concern was that the evidence-based program being planted in different places around the state is a good idea, but it'd be very difficult for some of the rural areas, and that it would be a lot easier on them, and maybe this is the reason that you're phasing this in. It'd be a lot easier for him if he was able to take evidence-based practices, not the full program, and implement what they could use or what they would find more easily incorporated than to have to take a whole program. And I'm not fully conversant with the problem, but I think there's a very good program in Eugene that a lot of people around the state are trying to copy. They've taken parts of it, but they can't afford to do the whole thing as is. How does that fit in with this?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, what you're describing is really the practice we have today, I believe, where our agencies and our providers are, for the most part, engaging in best practices. That has not turned out to be the most effective. It's certainly the least expensive way to provide services, but it's not the most effective. And we do know that being able to pick and choose practices and put them together does not necessarily result in effective services. I think that your constituents' concerns are legitimate in that if the state's expectation is a set of research-based services, the state has to be prepared to pay for those services. And I think that is a legitimate concern of the providers. And we will have to adjust to that. The outcome, however, that we also should be able to expect is better returns for the service, better outcomes for the service. So it's a part of why we were, as a work group, felt that we needed to have the phase in that's now in the bill to allow our providers and our agencies to work toward that. So if we have kids that or adults that spend less time in the programs but achieve better outcomes and it costs more, that's a fair deal.
A fair deal, I think.
For everyone.
Ben?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, another thing to consider is the fact that there are many types of evidence-based programs, and we hope that we aren't being overly prescriptive here. At least from the Department of Corrections point of view, we ask for some substantiation for programs in the research literature, and there are lots of different ways to go about it. So when you hear the term evidence-based, I hope you don't hear you have to do it this way. It means that you just base your individual program design on something that is substantiated in fact. In the adult corrections world, it's cognitive and behavioral programs that enjoy a lot of empirical support. But there are lots of different brands, and we would hope to work with our program providers to make sure that they have the right elements. They don't have to have the same program.
You may.
And I think probably the SWASTIC program in Grants Pass is research based. They're collecting quite a bit of research, and I think very effective. I like the idea that if you're going to mandate that you will be assisting many of these programs in anything, there's a bell curve where, you know, on one end you've got some people that are not performing, and on the other end you have quite a few that are doing a good job. So I think I see the flexibility there that they would certainly appreciate, and we would certainly want to encourage that they be given some flexibility. I would hope it's not going to be a one size fits all, but within that, then they'd be given some help, hopefully some funding, to allow them to really build a good program, in the sense that you're talking about with evidence based.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the case of SWASTIC, that is a highly evolved program, and they would be, at least in my opinion, having been familiar with them for a number of years, they would be considered an exemplary program anyway. But that's not to say that they shouldn't be held to the same standards.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think also some providers have seen earlier drafts of the bill that spoke to programs that would have required exact replications of particular programs, and the bill as it's written does not require exact replication of a few models.
I think that
programs.
Was the case. Hadn't seen the amendments.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question I'd like to put to Ben and to Karen for each of you about your programs. My reading of the Dash 1 amendments is that it requires us to move over a six-year period to a point where each of your programs would be 75% evidence-based. And what I'm wondering about is about that remaining 25% at the end of that process. Do you need that 25%? That is, are there programs that fall within your operations that can never be evidence-based, so you need to have it? And do you anticipate tensions as among different facilities or programs within your area of responsibility in needing that the protection of that remaining 25%? Is that going to be a disruptive force in the way you operate in the future if that's reached?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, speaking now only for the Department of Corrections, I would go 100%. And that's my own personal belief based on my almost 8 years of experience at the department. Now, we live in a more, excuse the pun, contained environment than many others, and many of the programs that we provide, we exert a tremendous amount of control over, with the exception of our community correction partners. So behind the walls programs, I see no reason why we can't have 100% of them operating within those parameters. I think when you're dealing with community-based programs, it's another kettle of fish, and that requires a tremendous amount of discussion. Mm-hmm. But I'm okay going 100% behind the walls.
Karen?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, and I don't know yet until after I feel like I want the opportunity to do the assessment, have a few years into it, and my hope is that the bill itself and the fact that Oregon is going in this direction will attract more evaluations to those areas where, in the juvenile world, as I mentioned before, there are some areas that are kind of under-evaluated for this group of kids. So I'm not quite where Ben is.
And I think your question I see everyone else wanting to chime
welcome
in.
Welcome,
Representative McPherson. So let's go ahead and just go down the line. Donna?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson. I think the other conversation that we had in the work group was the issue of innovative programs that have not yet been researched, but communities are really experimenting with and getting good results. We don't want to stifle or not have them be able to do that experimentation and put in practice things that work for particular rural communities or a particular population. So that's why we ask for the 25%, to look at innovative, creative opportunities as well.
Bob?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, one of the ways that I think about this is in regard to the state hospital. And prior to this biennium, we spent about 25% of our state mental health budget on the state hospital. Now, the state hospital only serves about 1,000 people out of 120,000 people we serve each year. And one reason it's so small is there is still a group of people that we're not really sure what's going to work, frankly. And they end up in state hospitals for long periods of time. So having some flexibility at the end to acknowledge that there are some people that we haven't figured out yet really what the best treatment is something I'm reasonably comfortable with, for example, in mental health, for that example. But, you know, in terms of the intent, I think going as close to 100% is where we ought to be headed. So I'm quite pleased with this sort of phase-in approach, and 75% seems like a logical end goal to shoot for at this point.
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons I thought, just because we're not having 100% of our programs mandated to be evidence-based doesn't mean the other 25% can be garbage. That's I don't want you to kind of slip into that implication there. I agree with what the other people here have said about innovative programs. The other thing that Dr. Walker discussed when he talked to this committee about evaluating effective juvenile crime prevention programs, and is important from my agency's perspective, is that he emphasized that kids don't come with a problem. They come in with a multitude of problems, and you have to have a comprehensive approach that addresses all or many of those factors before you can turn the kid around. And so we do know there's a research support basis for flexible or wraparound services that kind of give that cocoon approach. But I couldn't tell you right now whether those type of services meet the definition that's in Senate Bill 267. So that's an example of a practice that the research shows to be effective, but how it dovetails in with this, I couldn't tell you right now. And so that's why I think it's going to be a good conversation we're going to have over the next few years about how we do this, but it's not something that I personally would like to see go to 100% just because I'm not sure that in the type of programs that my agency funds and administers, that we'd be able to ratchet it down to this level of scrutiny, because I do think that this is a pretty strict standard that you're adopting here. And I don't want to mislead you on that, because I do think this is going to produce some changes, but I think that also calls for some flexibility in the approach and the level of funding.
And for the committee's information as well, it's would be the intent of the chair anyway, that this would be an issue that would stay on the Interim Judiciary Committee agenda. So at some point during the process, after passage of this legislation, but before the next regular session of the legislature, we would bring these folks back in. They could go through their administrative rules adoptions process, make the committee aware of issues, challenges, things that they weren't anticipating that may have come up, and it may require some further adjustment in the next legislative session. But I think it forces us to have the conversation and to get the ball rolling, and ties it directly to an issue that I think is the only way you motivate this kind of a change in the process, which is ultimately review of budget issues in meeting the needs of these programs. So that's sort of the intent. But I think this is going to be, as I think you pointed out, Bill, an ongoing conversation that the legislature and the agencies are going to be having about this issue all the way from now through the final implementation in the last phase at the 75% level.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to imply by my question that I thought the failure to go to 100% within the phase end was necessarily a defect in the bill. I just wanted to kind of air the reasons why that,
sure,
the purpose for that remaining 25% and how it was being viewed, and I think it was actually addressed very effectively by all the members of the panel.
Great, thank you. Are there further questions, counsel?
Sure. Mr. DeHaan, I understand that you may have Mr. Latessa back at some point in the next year or so.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, that's correct. He'll be here in October.
In October? Will he be here talking about issues like this, programs at work, evidence-based programs?
What we're I don't know if you recall the regular forums that we do.
Right.
This is the regular scheduled forum. The difference with this one is it will be sponsored by Portland State University, and it'll be stretched out to 2 days, a graduate seminar colloquium on one day, and then a meeting here in Salem for legislators, the press, anybody, a relatively large group.
People who run programs, too, and may be interested in
that's
finding more about evidence-based programs?
That's correct. And as far as we've got confirmation from Fox Butterfield, who will be talking about changes in this regard nationally. Joan Peter-Celia has been asked to come, who's an author and renowned researcher in the field, and then Ed Latessa has already agreed to come.
Thanks.
Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to first thank you for having the discussion we're having, because I think it's real important from the people I've spoken with or spoken to me as to making sure we set the record so we know exactly what's going to be anticipated and expected. So I really appreciate that. I have four or five things from based on what the panel set up. I'm not asking for each of you to respond, but I would like to get some responses if we could. What I know is that each of you participated in the work group, and I'm wondering, from what I've heard, it doesn't sound like any of the stakeholders slash providers or contractors that you use were actually at the table. And if that's the case, I'm wondering what type of feedback or input did they have while the work group was putting together what is now the Dash Ones. That's the first question.
I'd be glad to take the first crack at that. Phil Lemon. We presented the draft legislation twice to the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, which does have representation from a wide variety of people on it. It has been discussed. The local people at those meetings did express an interest in being more involved, and we relayed that to the work group and let it go at that. But as far we've had, I would say, mixed input. The JCPAC is also considering a number of policy changes to focus the juvenile crime prevention grants as the money grows shorter, and we've had very mixed input on those type of changes as well. But I would just say that this is obviously a significant undertaking that we're all going to have to work through, and that again is one of the reasons that I personally really advocated for the phase-in, because we're going to have to try these shoes on and walk them for a little while before we can wear them all the time.
Representative Williams, Representative Brzezinski. I also provided the local commissions on children and families with copies of the legislation as we were working on it, and also let them know that this work group was going on and let them know about what the discussions were in this work group. And they were able to provide feedback to me, which I then did bring back to the committee.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One of the things I've heard in some of the presentations was about the funding, the issues, making sure the funding. I've got to tell you, my stomach, as one of my early mentors, Peter Courtney, would say, it's kind of got a tickle in it and makes me wonder, because I flash back, Mr. Chair, almost to 1995 when we had SB 1145 going forward as to the community corrections and the need for funding. And what I'm hearing is that if we don't have the funding, it's going to be very difficult to really implement this, because we're not going to be able to set up the programs to have them research-based, analyzed to make certain whether they work. In the work group, what was discussed as to our obligation to make certain that there is sufficient funding for you as the agencies and then on down the line to the providers for special populations or for general populations to make certain that we are testing these and making certain that we're coming out with what I heard was the most important part is the outcome that is going to really charge us, not necessarily the cost of it, as long as we get better outcomes or the best outcomes. So can someone help me with what we are going to do about the funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, you raised an issue that's very important to the Department of Corrections, and I'll try and answer it this way. Again, we have more latitude in planning our programs internal to the department, so we'll have to set that aside for a moment. There's a tremendous amount of stress on our community programs now because of the funding crisis. And we have a long history, Ginger Martin is largely responsible for this, a long history of moving the local programs in this direction voluntarily. I think that she has been very persuasive with the community corrections directors, and I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress, again, voluntarily. But the fact that we are proposing to defund these programs in a very large way has exerted a chilling effect on their willingness to sign on for added responsibilities, because some of them, frankly, are considering opting out of the agreement. So it becomes a moot point if you're talking about the level of performance if you have no program to perform. So it is true that there's an issue out there brewing, and we don't know exactly how that's going to be resolved. I'm assuming there'll be adequate funding, or I'm hoping there'll be adequate funding for a very important part of our programs, and so then we can continue moving forward with this. If we take these programs back because they opt out, then I think we have to redefine what we're going to do for it.
And I just point out, Representative Brzezinski, that I think ultimately, as you move this direction, there is going to be some costs at the front end. I think the question is, can we afford not to do this? I mean, we can continue to spend money on programs that we only have sort of anecdotal evidence as to whether or not they're working or not. Or we can decide to invest in an approach that's going to get us into programs that we know that work and, hopefully save us money from programs that we learn don't work. And I just don't know that we can afford not to do this. Given the limited nature of the resource, it seems like it's our obligation to try to determine as best we can what programs are actually achieving the results, so as we decide what to do with that next marginal public safety dollar, we know where to put it. And I think that ultimately is where we need to be. And so I fully believe that we're going to hear some of these agencies come back and say, for us to even make this determination, it's going to cost us a little bit of money. And I hope we've just got the foresight to recognize that that's money ultimately well spent if what it's going to allow us to do is to achieve a better outcome by focusing those dollars and getting rid of some of the stuff that we're doing that, frankly, probably is maybe even costing us more money if it's driving people actually into higher rates of recidivism.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate everything you've said, because I agree with that philosophy. My only concern and reservation is, as we go forward with this process, how are we going to, or who's going to be making the decisions as to saying, no, this program is not working, or it doesn't show the benefit. I know the criteria still needs to be set up, and we're some time down. And I think that's part of the problem from some of the providers that I've heard from, is this uncertainty of how this process is going to play out and what are the rules going to be that they're going to be judged against for measurement. And so I assume through that process we're going to have a lot more input and participation from the stakeholders as to what they need, and there'll be the flexibility so long as, and this bill does not require the actual funding. I'm not sure. Is this something else that we're going to be seeing, or is this going to go through Ways and Means as to the money side of this?
No, I think because, in the first round, I think it's fairly limited in its impact. And I think, I don't think that we are anticipating the necessity of that in the 2003-2005 budget cycle. As it phases in, I think that's going to be a conversation that we're going to have, and I anticipate that, you asked the question, who's going to be making that determination? In part, I think that's going to be an oversight role that this committee and the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety will serve. And in other instances, and I'm going to let Mr. Lemon respond to that, but in other instances, I think each of the stakeholders we see at the table here will have the responsibility with their own agencies of being able to certify that what they're doing meets these requirements as they come forward to the legislature at the beginning of each legislative session. Mr. Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out again that I think there's just reason for concern and some nervousness, because I don't have my rules written, I can tell you right now. But I would point out that in the bill, the agencies here first report back to this committee about a year from now, in September of 2004. And what we will have for you then is at least the beginning of a program-by-program assessment of which programs we think do and do not meet the standards in this legislation, where we are in the rules process. This bill directs us to work with stakeholders to develop the goals and develop our rules. And so there's going to be a lot of public process going into this, and you're going to hear back from us in a year. And if there are problems then you folks are the ones who write the laws, and you're the ones who can change the laws. And we'll be back here to have that conversation with you.
Mr. Chair, Karen?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, as the work group was looking at all of the drafts and making suggestions, I made all the drafts available to the juvenile department directors and all of those providers that the Youth Authority contracts with. And I will tell you that neither of those groups was particularly happy with any of the drafts that they saw, and you may hear from some of them later today. I don't know if they're happy with the final draft either. I do think, though, that it is a challenge, but as the director of the Youth Authority, I'm not asking the provider group to do anything that I'm not asking my own agency to do. And all of us talk about the increased needs and challenges of the youth in the juvenile system. And the only way we will meet those needs is to change what we are providing to them. And I'm not expecting that the Youth Authority is going to drop a bunch of providers. I'm expecting that we will work with them to identify the kinds of programs that we need to be providing to them, and those providers and the Youth Authority staff will be given ample opportunity to make those changes or not. And there will come a time when, if they choose not to, then the Youth Authority will no longer contract with them.
Mr. Chair, one more, if I may.
One more.
And this is really the follow-up with Representative Anderson. And, Karen, I'm going to start off with you, because I heard in your response to him that you think it's the focus will be on the outcome, making certain that we're really getting the most bang for the buck and the outcomes that we can increase whatever we want to achieve. And I'm wondering, for all of the programs, is that really what we're trying to do? We're using what is being known as evidence-based research to reach what we think is a desired outcome as to what the performance of these programs should be. And our goal is to make certain that we can better serve the individuals coming through the various programs and being successful in completing the program through whatever modifications that they may have to go through to be able to meet their obligations within society.
Mr. Chair and Representative Prozanski, I believe that's the intent of the bill. And if we had a way to simply determine the outcome for every client or youth or inmate, we could track it on the basis of that person. But I think we all realize that our respective clients go through so many different systems that it's hard to then tie it to an outcome related to that individual. So we've kind of dropped back a notch and said, then let's look at the kinds of programs that these systems provide. I think in the best of all worlds, it would be far better to really look at the outcomes of the clients purely. But that's very difficult to do when they start as preschoolers in some of the programs that Donna Systems provide and may end up in Ben's program. It's hard to really judge any one of the interventions and tag it to that individual.
And the other challenge, obviously, is when you can't do it individual by individual, then you have to back up and you have to do essentially a statistical sample of in a longitudinal aspect of a whole bunch of people over a long period of time. And the reality is we can't afford to do longitudinal studies on every program that every one of these groups is doing. And so the way you want to do that on some of them, you certainly want to try to do that on the innovative programs that you're moving with. But what you want to do is at some point you want to back up and say, instead of us doing the longitudinal study on this program, let's look at a program that somebody else has already done the research on, where we know what the results are likely going to be based on the tools they use to implement it. And that way we can anticipate what the outcome is likely going to be. So, you know, it's not going to be a substitute for needing to do some of that longitudinal data. But, you know, frankly, if you want to talk about cost, a real outcome-based approach where, you know, we would run the kind of longitudinal studies on all of your programs that we would need to do to really determine the outcomes would be far more expensive in the long run in trying to accomplish that.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, Representative Crummell, I was going to let the panel free. You have a question.
Well, I do, Mr. Chair, and I will try to condense things down as much as I can. Relative to on page...
Can I briefly interrupt you?
Yes.
Based on the extent that we're taking this bill today and the amount of testimony, I'm going to hold over Senate Bill 24 and Senate Bill 308 because I think we'll use the balance of our time today with the remaining witnesses. So if you're here on Senate Bill 24 and Senate Bill 308, I'm going to let you go. We'll reschedule those bills for Thursday. I apologize for the inconvenience in keeping you here this long. Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. what would, with regards to on page 2, sub 5 and section 3 there, starting on line 5, talks about the scientifically based research, and I'm just wondering, with regards to that, what's going to be considered to be accepted as reliable and statistically valid, and and sort of this is sort of a two-pronged question. And then relative to that, are we looking that at reinventing the wheel, or are we going to use programs that already have national norms and have been proven in other areas to be statistically valid in terms of the outcomes?
Do you want to go, Ben, and then Bob?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, there are lots of ways to test program performance. One of the things that we've been thinking a lot about, to get to your point, is that we can learn from the experience of others. Probably the best example is that I can tell you that if you exercise, don't eat too much, don't smoke, you're going to be healthier longer, because statistically that's been shown in many, many studies. I don't have to follow you around individually. I just have to check, you've been smoking lately, you've been drinking too much, you get the picture. So there are ways to do that programmatically. In the corrections business, we can provide programs and check their conformance, and the technology's developed. There are instruments that you use to make sure the programs have all the active ingredients that'll probably get you the outcome. And that, as far as I'm concerned, given the state of social science now, it's absolutely possible without tracking every individual in the system. I hope that answered your question.
Mr. Nickel?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel. From the mental health, let me give you an example. In adult mental health, we've worked with a nationally published center. A lot of this comes out of Dartmouth, New Hampshire Psychiatric Research Center. They've already identified the six practices, and there may be a few others that are going to add to the list, that work with people with severe and persistent mental illnesses. They've also already created what they call fidelity scales, which allow us, as Ben was alluding to have tools that are already developed that allow us to quickly assess where programs are at and give a numerical rating, actually, to say, they're 80% there or 70 or 50 or whatever. I anticipate that our internal process with our stakeholders will help flesh that process out. We'll come to some agreement about what the standards would be, and then we'll go forward with that.
Okay. I guess what I'm pointing to, if I may, Mr. Chair, is one of the criticisms 12 years ago when Sim and Cam were started in the education world was that the State Department of Education basically chose to reinvent the wheel rather than utilizing instruments that were already out there and statistically valid and had national norms attached to them. And what I'm driving at here is that I don't want to spend a lot of dollars reinventing the wheel. If there are instruments and there are programs that we know that are already statistically valid, and what is considered an acceptable level? If it meets if it's at the 0.5 percent confidence level, is that good, or are you willing to let it go at 0.25? I mean, so I guess that's what I'm pointing to, and I don't want us to fall in the same trap that we fell into with education 12 years ago. Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
You may.
Thank you. Relative to on page 3 and other pages, it talks about in sub 4, starting on line 9, it talks about actually skipping down to about line 11 or 12, I guess, that the Legislative Assembly shall consider the agency's failure to meet requirements of the subsection and making appropriations to the agency in the following biennium. When we are presented with the budget for OYA and Department of Corrections, if this bill passes, is this going to be part of the performance measures that are attached to that budget, or is this going to be one of those we'll wait and see sort of deals?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krummel, as I read the bill, I've anticipated that each of the agencies would make a report in the interim to this body, and then you all would make a response to that. That would then be discussed as our individual agency budgets came up during this session. I hadn't anticipated it being part of a performance measure, though it certainly could be.
Council, you wanted a comment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is one of these areas that I had long discussion with Virginia Vanderbilt, the drafter, on this particular provision. What this is one legislature cannot bind the next. So this legislature could not pass a law on its own. It would have to be constitutional that says the next legislature will have to do something or cannot do something. So what the language says is they shall consider. Well, they shall consider, but they're not directed to do anything. So it would be part of their consideration, but it no way binds them. You can't bind the next legislature, except through a constitutional amendment.
So it can't. They can't be. We can't punish them for something that they're not going to do 2 years in advance. All we can do is point out that they have to come in and report to the next legislature, and that it's something that they will, that the next legislature should consider in evaluating their budgets. And that was language that Representative Patridge, chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee, and I had some conversation about as well, because I think, you know, that there is a desire, and so it doesn't fit within the set of performance, the defined performance measures. Yet, over time, that might be an appropriate place for it to go, Representative. But I think for right now, the idea is that they would come back, they would report to this committee in the interim, and then this would be part of the discussion they had as their budgets went through the normal Ways and Means budget process cycle.
What I don't want to do, Mr. Chair, is create a situation where we have placed a performance measure on the agency in one part of the statute, but it doesn't relate to another part of the statute. And consequently, when it comes time to evaluate their budgets, either it gets lost in the shuffle, or the agency sort of loses sight of the fact, and I'm not trying to be critical here, but loses sight of the fact that that is something that's tied to some of the dollars or to the dollars that they're going to be getting. I don't want to create a conflict for the agencies in that respect. And I'm also wanting to make sure that we're sort of all on the same page. Because it would make sense to make this part of their performance measures. And I don't have a problem with it being in this bill, but I would also want to see it as part of their budgeting process, both for, you know, in terms of the 03-05 biennium, what does this mean? That they're going to be making reports during the course of the biennium at how they're doing it getting here.
Right.
And then I would assume that then in the 05-07 biennium, they're going to be making reports about how those dollars are being utilized and that sort of thing. I just want to make sure that we all end up on the same page and that we don't wind up being separated like twins at birth. The other question that I have, if I may, Mr. Chair, is this going to enable, and I recognize that this doesn't take effect until the 05-07 biennium, but is this going to basically enable a shift in funds from DHS to DOC? I mean, because I'm assuming that some of the things that would be that DHS may be responsible for now, they're not going to have responsibility for, because where those kids are at, they're going to be shifted over to DOC. So are funds going to follow those kids, or will we sort of end up paying twice? How is that going to work?
Mr. Chair, could I speak first and represent? I was assuming the shift would be the other way around.
Here we go. Start the punishment. Right now. Do you want to take a shot? I mean, ultimately, I don't know that it's anticipating any shift of funds. I mean, to the extent that happens, Representative Crummell, I think it happens as a result of as the evidence develops and where money might be best used. And if you've got a whole bunch of stuff that isn't working someplace and you got, you know, I mean, I think there's still going to be the need for the agencies to come in and make the justification as to why money ought to stay in a particular spot in the program. So I don't anticipate ultimately this changing with respect to dollars shifting among these agencies in a defined way. I think that's ultimately going to be the result of the evidence that's put forward, and that'll be a decision that the Ways and Means Committee and the balance of the legislature would get to make, like they do now with respect to every one of these agencies' budgets. Go ahead.
Representative Crummell, to the extent that this propels us towards more effective programs, at least in my world, would reduce the number of people returning to a prison system and hopefully free up some money that could be invested in some other way. I mean, so you could argue that to do a good job here is to actually transfer money the other way to programs to keep people out of the prison system. But who knows? I mean, that's a long leap, but it's possible.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much. We appreciate your time this afternoon and your time on this subject with the work group. I'm now going to call up the next panel, Mary Botkin, Janet Ahrens, Steve Dole. And why don't we hold there with just three so we're not too overdone, and we'll pick up the next couple next up. Mary, do you want to lead off for us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Like a lot of folks, I got these amendments, you know, a few hours ago. But I actually did have a chance to kind of go through them and look at them. You know, I love my bill, and I always get a little nervous when somebody tells me, we're not going to gut your bill, we're just going to add to it and make it better. You know, but I actually think the chairman has done that, and the work group has done that to a large degree, made the bill better in that it has done some, it's actually taken a step that most legislatures have been a little fearsome of taking, and that is to actually make sure that the programs we fund inside our agencies are effective, accomplish something, and have some, you know, measurable outcome that we can see that they're producing the kind of results that we want to produce. Because of that, we're generally supportive of these amendments. I think that there's a couple of general concerns that we have. We don't want to slow them down. We don't want to slow the bill down. But we don't see anybody outside looking over there, I mean, kind of doing this. And I always get a little concerned. If you ask me if my budget is efficient, I will tell you that I have the most efficient budget, Council 75, of anybody. If our field director looks at my budget, he might not think that my budget is as efficient as it should be, and vice versa. Sometimes it's good to have somebody studying the studies. And I know that there's a bill down in Ways and Means now that's, you know, going to try and fund some things that would actually do this. As I said, I don't want to slow things down. I just think that the Interim Judiciary Committee needs to be very diligent in making sure that the information that you're getting is not self-serving and that the information is objective, and I'm sure that you will do that. It's my only caution, is let's just be sure that what we're looking at is objective and real. Because right now, a lot of the stuff we get is not very real. And with that, I would support the amendments. I'd support the bill. And I'd just as soon not answer any questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mary. In that case, you're not allowed to ask Mary any questions.
I'm going to ask for an exception on that.
Janet.
Thank you very much. I'm Janet Ahrens. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. We are a statewide association of over 30 provider nonprofit agencies. We address the treatment needs of children, youth, and families in juvenile justice, addiction issues for children with developmental disabilities, on mental health issues, and for children who've been abused and neglected. So we pretty much run the gamut, and we touch the children that you're talking about and operate the programs that you're addressing in the bill today. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, particularly since this is a work session. We really appreciate it. I've submitted some written testimony and some comments from a sampling of our members as well. Rather than review that, what I'd like to do is respond to some of the comments and questions that were posed by the panel previous. and the legislators here on the committee members here today. We support many of the comments that were made by the panel and the state agencies. We agree with much of what they presented to you today and their positions and their rationale. We are supportive of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. We share your concern that we provide programs that have accountability and have results. The comments that were made about rural communities and minorities, you'll see reflected in our testimony, our written testimony, that we share the same concerns that were raised by the panel previous to us. Representative Anderson talked about flexibility and the ability to use evidence-based practices. He's raised an important question, and we appreciate that very much. Many of our agencies already use evidence-based practices and do so with great successes. I think you mentioned specifically SOASTIC in your district and their ability to be effective without necessarily using a blueprint or having the imposition of an evidence-based program in the whole, which you referred to. It was a great example of some of the places where we've had exceptional results from the use of evidence-based practices and the ability to be more flexible in how we present our services to children and youth. The cost issue was really important, raised also by Representative Prozanski and referred to by some other committee members. This will be very important in how we evaluate the ability to be able to provide evidence-based practices and evidence-based programs. I'm very excited to see that it's included as an evaluation piece in the amendments. I think that's very appropriate. That's certainly something that we would want to have in there. We see a lot of comment in the bill about cost savings. We hope that that would be the result, but we're concerned on the front end that it will not be. And we're concerned when we meet with, in fact, we just met a couple of weeks ago with the Oregon Youth Authority and children, adults, and families to talk about rates and levels of reimbursement for current contracts that we've had in place for about 5 years on behavioral rehabilitation services. And those state agencies acknowledge that they're currently underfunding those contracts by about 30%. And when we're struggling to run programs without even cost of living increases, it makes us very nervous to see the imposition of unfunded ideas. So we're hoping that both the legislature and the state agencies are going to take that into consideration when we move to more discussion about how we might be able to implement some of these concepts. It's going to be critical in our ability to be successful and produce for you what you're trying to achieve with the bill. Not stifling innovation, particularly, and Donna Middleton mentioned this, particularly around populations, again, specialty populations and rural communities is going to be very important. There were a couple of other references made by the committee and by the panel about the success and innovation of a number of programs that are already out there, and we appreciate your recognition of how important that is in a good business model, as well as how important that's going to be to the state's ability to tailor what Chair Williams referred to as a federal movement to begin to provide more accountability. And Oregon is a state that has many unique characteristics, populations, and issues to address, and flexibility is going to be very important, as will be innovation. We also appreciate very much Chair Williams' acknowledgement to evaluate the process and the impact of the intent of the bill, particularly after the administrative rules were adopted, and your interest in seeing an ongoing conversation and some regular communication with the legislature during the interim. This is an important part of the process as well. We want to make sure that the bill is going to achieve what you want, and in fact that would be one amendment that we would ask the chair consider putting his own remarks into the bill to talk about what it is that we may want to achieve in an evaluation of whether or not we're actually getting the product that we're looking for. Being at the table, and again, my thanks to Representative Prozanski for raising that issue, we would love to have been at the table in the early discussions about the development of this bill and the concepts in the bill. We have a lot to contribute. Within my association alone, we have hundreds of years of experience, hands-on experience, and research, work, innovation, and providing services to children and youth and families throughout the state of Oregon in every corner of this state and in all of your districts. And we always look for opportunities to be able to provide that experience and put it on the table. We're excited. Many people are excited about the opportunities that are represented in this bill. There is some anxiousness around it. You'll see that reflected in both the written testimony that was submitted and comments from some of my member agencies. And that is primarily a result of not having had an opportunity to be at the table early on or to even have copies of LC draft or the amended bill early enough to be able to respond in a thoughtful way and make the kinds of contributions we would like to have. So my apologies for some of the anxiousness that's reflected there, but I'd like to assure you that we are supportive. We like the challenge. We like the change. We like the direction. We just want to make sure that it's a true working partnership as we try and build on the concepts in the bill. My thank you again, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Janet. Steve.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I have to say this. When I heard Floyd Przanski's mouthing the words that were reflective of my thoughts, it gave me a warm glow and made me shudder all in the same moment. But I have to say that, and I say it with all due respect because Floyd and I were through that 1145 issue, and many of the things that we had trepidations about at that time, sure enough, have come to fruition. So I appreciate his remarks, and I think they should be taken to heart. Generally, we're supportive of this, but we have some concerns. You know, we want what works, because if we can find ways, at least in the area of crime, to prevent crime, that's going to mean fewer victims on the street, and that's what's important. That's, I think, what we all want. I share Ms. Botkin's concerns about an audit function. I think that's something that we do a very poor job of in government. And I'll just point out to you that you know, as part of the juvenile code back in 1995, the introduction to that juvenile code or the lens that we look at it through, there's an audit function there. And since we've had that, since 1995, we have not audited, except for the OYA itself, we have not audited one county juvenile department. The only audit we've done outside of the OYA is the Deschutes County program. And that audit actually, quite frankly, was a whitewash because it wasn't an audit. It was a comparative analysis or a comparative study. So it was very disappointing, and we spent a lot of money on it. So I look forward to the day when we can have true audits of these. And if the Secretary of State can't do them, then maybe we should take that money to a private firm. I don't care if it's Deloitte and Touche, or I don't even know if they exist anymore, the way these big firms change nowadays, but I think we ought to take a look and make sure that we audit more. The other thing that concerns me about this, and I saw some of the preliminary drafts of this, and I have not been able to spend a lot of time with this, but I'm concerned about the area of competitive studies, and by that I mean this. If we've got a program, or somebody comes to us with a program that says, this is the greatest thing since Coca-Cola, that we don't get two or three programs that are lockstep with each other and say, well, they're all saying it's great, better than Coke, so we ought to go this way. Let's find two or three studies that are saying the opposite and then weigh them against each other. Likewise, the flip side. If we're getting some that say, no, this doesn't work, let's get out there and find some that say the flip of that. And here's why I bring this up. And I know that you've heard me hammer on this Deschutes program over the years. I know I've spent at least more than 1 hour and less than 15 in front of this committee talking about Deschutes County, but we ran across something the other day that really gave me pause around this. And there's a, and I there's a study at Portland State University at something called the Executive Leadership Institute, which is part of the Legacy Program for State and Local Public Services Through Leaders, which supposedly was supposed to study this Deschutes program. And it appeared after looking through this, we found that there was a uncritical acceptance of the program in this study, that there was that the study was obviously more advocacy than inquiry. And quite frankly, we'd like to see our academic institutions provide credible scientific analysis so that the public can have confidence that public policy is headed in the right direction. And none of that occurred here. What it looked like to me, with all due respect, is that somebody walked in with their program, being Deschutes County, with the YIP program, and said, we'd like your stamp of approval on this so we can gain academic credibility. What a great deal. And what we know is the truth is that we know the failure of this program, as reported in the Deschutes or the Bend Bulletin, that we had 77 kids in a program where there were 220 new violations while the program existed. 54 of those were felonies, including an attempted murder, 71 misdemeanors, 95 violations. Yet, when you look at Portland State, and they've got it on their website, getting back to, they'd tell you this was the greatest thing since Coke. Now, if we're going to use academic institutions, and quite frankly, I've attended a number of classes at academic institutions and seminars in the last number of years, and I have to tell you, I'm finding them to be more like madrasas than universities. They're a long ways from where I went to school. And I'm sorry to have to say that, I really am. I go to seminars on sentencing or the death penalty, and all we hear one point of view. You know what? I'm all for that, but let's get in somebody else that says something else, that gives the other prevailing view, before we just march off in lockstep. So I don't mean to preach here. Like I say, hey, whatever we can do to find the infamous magic bullet, we're all for. But I would encourage you to put in an audit, an independent audit function in this, whether it's the Secretary of State or whether we go outside the government, because I don't think we should have the infamous fox guarding the hen house. And I would also encourage you to make sure that we look at, if we bring in studies that say it's a good deal, we bring in studies that say maybe it isn't a good deal, and vice versa. And I appreciate your time, and I want to, you know, one of our main concerns, or it's an area of the criminal justice system that I've spent a lot of time in and am quite involved in because of the situation that happened in my life, is the area of juvenile justice. And a friend of mine wrote this, and I'd like to leave you with this. A back-to-basic approach with kids is what works. It's not complicated, although professors would like you to think it is. Just like good parenting, juvenile offenders respond to early certain sanctions, consistent accountability, required educational expectations, and rewards for doing well. Any realistic crime reduction program must face the fact that in the final analysis, the decision to break society's rules is an individual one that must be the responsibility of the individual who makes it. And no life history, however painful, can excuse it. No government program, however efficient, can substitute for personal integrity. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Are there questions for the panel?
Well, I have one, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Cromwell.
Ms. Botkin, were you included in the discussions about the amendments to this bill?
No, sir, I was not.
Okay.
Can I make one observation, or one further observation? There was a comment made by the earlier panel about funding transfers from the Department of Corrections to one of the other agencies. And it was kind of a light comment, and I understand that, and I don't want to take it too seriously. But you know what? I just have to make an observation. In the 18-plus years I've been in this building, the only thing the Department of Corrections has gotten from other agencies is their failures. We've never gotten a dime of their money. Our budget has not seen any kind of cost of living increases for more sessions than I can count. And, you know, we just seem to inherit everybody's problems. And, you know, with the closure of all our mental health facilities at the state level, now we're the largest mental health institution as well. And, you know, I just have to say, our folks that work there are not trained to handle kind of clients that we're getting. We're not getting any of the training funds that we used to have in those companion institutions. You know, when we had our mental health facilities open, our people who worked there could not work a floor in a mental health facility without at least 25 hours of training, and usually more than that. Our corrections officers get a couple hours that, you know, of real basic mental health training. That's about it. And, you know, I just have to say that, you know, we're expecting a lot of folks who, quite frankly, aren't trained or prepared to deal with some of the clients that we have now. And it would be nice just to have the other agencies take their own failures and deal with them.
Department of Corrections.
Yeah, but it's sort of the job, you guys, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. Had to say that.
And Mary, I just as a comment, I mean, you weren't included necessarily in the work group on the amendments, but you've been aware from me that...
Yes,
that
you were working on something.
Yeah, that the bill would be receiving amendments at some point.
Okay. I'm sorry, and I did not mean to indicate that I did not know that.
Yeah, okay.
I was aware that there were... As you said, Mr. Chair, improvements coming for your bill.
That's right. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to start losing committee members here because of other commitments, so I want to bring up Gina Furman and Angela Kimball, who are the last two witnesses to testify. And if I could ask you to make your points as quickly and as saliently as possible, the committee would appreciate it. Begin.
Chair Williams, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I represent all 36 mental health program directors in the state. We have not taken official position on this bill. We were not directly involved. However, I have a lot of faith in the people that were involved in crafting this bill. I work closely with Bob, Donna, Ben, Karen and Phil. So we knew at some point in time we would be brought into this process. We are very much in support of evidence-based practices. We think that it's the way to go. However, in the mental health field, we're very, very concerned because we think that the legislature is going the opposite direction. Supported employment, that's an evidence-based practices. That line item has basically been zeroed out. We no longer have that. So we're going the opposite direction. Crisis services, money's been taken out of that. Non-Medicaid adult mental health, that line has been decimated. So there's not a lot of money in the system. We try to do promising practices, evidence-based practices. Are there places that we can get better at? You bet. We're anxious to work with Bob Nickel. I've been attending a committee of evidence-based practices, people that want to get evidence-based practices into the state and hone the ones that we do have. We're excited to work on that. I would just caution you that I think there is something to many of the questions that you've been asking about, do we actually have the funds to do this? There's not a lot of evidence-based practices that are identified. Some of them are very expensive, and I think we do need to talk about how do we fund the mental health system that we want, that we currently are not funding.
Okay. Thank you, Gina.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball. I'm with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, but I'm actually speaking to you independent of that organization since we've not had a chance to review this bill as a collective organization. However, I would like to let you know that as a parent of a child with a serious mental health disorder, who at one point was involved in the juvenile justice system, that this is indeed a topic that affects so many of our members. In fact, the Criminal Justice Commission statistics point out that 27.8% of youth are indicated to have serious mental health issues. So these do affect our family members very dramatically and very personally. And I would say that we are very much in favor of using evidence-based practices. For example, the MST program, which I know is in use in Multnomah County, has some of the finest therapists I have ever seen, and their commitment to working in a very unified and comprehensive manner with kids with mental health disorders is astounding.
For those of us who don't know the jargon, MST is multisystemic therapy, right?
Thank you, Chair Williams. That is correct.
I want to make sure.
And there are other evidence-based practices that the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill itself is responsible for providing. Family psychoeducation, for example, is an evidence-based practice, and we're proud to offer that, and it does have good effects on the ability of people to cope and to recover from mental illness. On the other hand, we would like to caution, as Gina Furman just did, about the effects of the budget cuts on the mental health system. When you talk about evidence-based treatment practices, what you're talking about are programs that are cost-effective. That does not mean they are cheap programs. They usually have upfront costs that are fairly high because of the training involved. The fidelity measures, in fact, create this need to have administrative oversight in layers, in effect, of administration that may be greater than you currently have. And what I'd like to leave you with is it feels as though you've given a budget for a kitchen remodel of $5,000, and you want the best materials and the best outcomes, so you've demanded granite counters. You're going to be left washing the dishes in a rubber bucket. And I feel like that is what is happening to our mental health system. It has been dramatically underfunded, and now you're asking to do the best thing with what remaining funds are left there. And I suggest to you that evidence-based treatment programs, while cost-effective, usually focus on a very discrete population. And when you do that, all the square pegs that don't fit into the round holes get cast aside, unless there's enough flexibility in the funding and adequate funding to catch those that don't fit the narrow parameters of evidence-based programs. Just a caution.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you very much. I just want to say in response, colleagues, to a couple of comments that I think that some of these comments that have been made are, I think, very appropriate. I think the amendments to the bill that the work group came up with does allow for that phased-in flexibility. And obviously, with respect to the audit function, the oversight function, while I think that's an issue that is going to need to bear further discussion over time, ultimately it's us and it's the members of the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee and the full Ways and Means Committee, and then all of the legislature together that has the fundamental oversight responsibility for make sure that we're spending these resources appropriately. My sense is that there is going to be, as we look at this issue, a recognition that some of these evidence-based programs do in fact have some upfront costs, but that's also the reason that the cost-effectiveness language is included in the bill. And that is, in fact, the point. The point is to spend the money where it's going to make the most difference to the most amount of people, that next marginal available dollar argument. And I don't think you get there unless you start having this conversation and start moving this direction. This is a long process. It was designed to be a long process. It was designed to phase in over time with a lot of involvement from the stakeholders and a lot of involvement from this committee and the rest of the legislature as this progress moves forward. Or as this bill moves forward. So those are sort of my concluding comments to the committee about the bill, and I would commend it to you with the amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I will move the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 267.
Representative McPherson moves the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 267. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the amendments? The amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 267 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 267 as amended by the -1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Representative Krummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the work and the issues around evidence-based types of programming, and I actually do support utilizing evidence-based as opposed to best practices types of things. I would like to just make a couple of comments, and that part of the bill I would support. Although I think that Mr. Dole made a very good comment when he was talking about expectations, I think one of the things, and I relate this back to our educational system, as some would say has gone into the tank, is probably because in the 70s we took discipline out of the schools, and we took a lot of authority away from teachers and administrators, and then we developed a lot of administrators that had no guts. Consequently, we ended up with a system that we've been rebuilding for the last 10 or 15 years, and I think justifiably so. with regards to the mental health institutions and the closure thereof, I think you can go back a couple of administrations and thank the governor and the people then that were saying that, you know, institutions don't necessarily meet the needs of the mentally ill, and so consequently we need to do this. And so we have in essence, because of those types of actions, had probably the unintended consequence of making the Department of Corrections our mental health institution and our mental health provider of maybe not choice, but that's the way it has worked out. With regards to the other part of the bill, I'm not going to support the bill because of the first part of the bill that makes changes to the DPS, BPSST, make changes to the policy committees. And so for that reason, I'm going to be a no vote on this bill, and I will be a no on the floor.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Crummel. Nancy, go ahead and call the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
Just real quick. I'm going to be supporting the bill to the floor. I have got some reservations, as I've noted on the record. The audit function, I think, is something that is kind of ironic to read that we're looking at shutting down or the funding of some of those in the Secretary of State's, which is really our check and balance that we have at this point. And so I hope that we are going to continue to look at that, and knowing the current state of the SB 1145 and the counties that have already given their notices, that we're not going to have the same fate here. It seems to me, I know the chair has pledged his desire to see this go forward, and I too want to see outcome based that are effective and efficient, but we need to be able to measure those and judge them. And of course, as we've heard from all the players, it's going to be our obligation, as what it was in 1145, to make sure we fully fund them.
All right, now Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Excused.
Grummel?
No.
McPherson?
Aye.
Wazanski?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Wood?
Aye. Senate Bill 267, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll assign myself carrier of the bill. And with that, committee, thank you for your patience. We're adjourned for the afternoon.